We have Mark Adams from the Learn to Fly Center.
Tell us about the Pilot Proficiency Project.
Well, the Pilot Proficiency Project is something that is brand new at EAA AirVenture this year. We're doing it as a joint venture with EAA, NAFI, and the organization that I'm the chairman of, the Society of Aviation and Flight Educators, called SAFE. And we have felt for a long time that the Learn to Fly Center was certainly an important thing in getting people interested and involved in starting in aviation. But we needed something that would allow for recurrency and proficiency of the pilots that are already rated. So we came up with the pilot proficiency program concept, and Rod Hightower was good enough to say, all right, we like it, let's do it. We're going to put you in a Learn to Fly Center because it makes sense to have you over there. And so we started this year, and what it is a series of forums that are aimed at the top 10 accident cause factors. And then in the afternoons, we have 9 slots in a Redbird full motion simulator that pilots can sign up for. And we have about 10 challenging scenarios that they'll be able to fly. They get about an hour with an instructor, brief time, some time in a sim, and a debrief. We also have the Redbird crosswind trainer, so folks can come out and practice their crosswind technique, because that's a major accident cause factor as well. To date, it's been a resounding success.
So it's not really to learn to fly, it's like remember to fly.
It is. Or continuing flying.
Can you touch on those top 10 accident cause mechanisms?
Sure. One of the very top one is loss of control, and it's been there for years. A lot of the forms are from some of our experts in the industry, such as Rich Stoll, who's affectionately known as the Spin Doctor, who teaches upset recovery, emergency maneuvers training. We have several scenarios in the sim that are classic setups that pilots typically get themselves into a loss of control situation. So they have the opportunity to participate in the forums and then get in the simulator and try their skills at the scenarios that put them into the challenging situations that can cause those type of accidents. Other accidents are what we call VFR and IMC conditions. Pilots flying in good weather into instrument conditions, and a lot of them are actually instrument rated, but don't take the proper steps that they need to when they get into that situation. So we have those programmed into the scenarios as well, for them to practice doing exactly what they need to do.
Well, it sounds like in the case of an instrument-rated pilot flying into IMC inadvertently, that he just doesn't want to believe it's IMC until it's too late.
It could be that that's a lot of it. That can happen, and if you're not prepared for it mentally, to make the transition into those conditions, those first few seconds and actually the first couple of minutes can be very challenging, and a lot of folks are just not up for it.
Well, the big problem with something like that is disorientation. They're not used to just looking out the windows and seeing gray.
Exactly right. And one of the particular scenarios that we have, this is actually nighttime conditions, which makes it even
more
challenging.
Sure, make it even more challenging.
Exactly.
That's it.
What kind of reactions do you get from the pilots that have gone through the program?
The feedback that we've been getting, everybody has thought this is phenomenal. I've had folks tell me this is some of the best training I've had. I've never flown a simulator, but this is awesome to have this kind of experience that I can't do in the airplane. The feedback has been tremendous.
Now, will this be a traveling program? The crown jewel is the simulator time.
Yes.
But there's how many simulators around the country?
Well, actually, there's Redbird's probably approaching 300 of these units out in the field. And, of course, they are one of many manufacturers. But they have certainly, Jerry Guigard and the folks over there, have been extremely generous to this program and to our organization as well in providing the simulator. But they can easily go to Redbird's website. It's redbirdsimulators.com, and they can find a location that has the simulators. One of the things that Redbird is going to do is they're going to make these scenarios available to the Redbird operators after the show here. So they will be able to actually have the simulator scenarios that can be done at a local level.
That's interesting. What kind of cost is this going to be to the pilot?
There's no cost at all to the folks coming to the Learn to Fly Center. The forums, the simulator, both of them are free. So free education.
I imagine you've got quite a waiting line.
We have 9 slots every day, and we start at 8 o'clock for that day, and we're usually signed up by about 10.
Oh, 8, 10, yeah?
Yep.
10 after 8, I mean. Can the scenarios be tailored to the type of aircraft? In other words, I'm Joe 172, 150 pilot. You're not going to stick me in a Saratoga or something.
No. And actually, this year we limited to 172 because that's the most popular training aircraft in existence. And it's very easy transition for anybody coming from high performance to that. And, of course, folks with a little less experience, it's an easy trainer to fly. So we've stuck with that this year.
Well, that must be fun, and getting that into a spin.
Yeah, for sure. Are there any online materials that can help you out with this spin training course?
There are a number of folks that you can go to, richdole.com, his website. He has a lot of material. Rich has written several books on upset recovery and emergency maneuvers training. I would encourage folks to go check that out. APS in Phoenix is another provider of that type of training, and their website, they can get information there as well. Also, our website for our members, the Society of Aviation and Flight Educators at safepilots.org, our reference center, or resource center, has a lot of the articles that have been written by some of the experts that's available to them.
What other scenarios do you have besides loss of control? Partial panel failure, nighttime, that kind of stuff?
We actually have two nighttime scenarios, and we also have some max performance takeoff and landing scenarios out of a airport in Idaho that will challenge them. Maximum crosswind, you mentioned the classic stall spin. We have a scenario that has resulted in several folks getting into that exact situation as an arrival in here to Oshkosh.
Now, that's interesting.
We do have one big bonus scenario, too, for all the naval aviators out there. You can take off out of San Diego Lindbergh and land on the Ronald Reagan that's in port.
Oh, nice. Let's go.
With a 747?
You know, I've tried to do that a number of times on Microsoft Flight Simulator. I either do a high flyby or I smack the back of the boat. I hate when that happens.
Well, you need to come on over and try it.
Oh, no, I can't. I'm not wrecking your simulator. No way.
Yeah, that, not like the last time. What is your goal for this type of training? For everyone to take it every couple of years? I mean, the sky's the limit goal is what I'm thinking here.
Well, actually, and we'd really love to see people do this at least on an annual basis. You know, in the air carrier industry, we train every 6 months. And the accident, the low accident rate reflects that type of training. Not everybody's going to do that. But with the advent of these simulators, it makes it much, much easier to go and train on a regular basis, and that's the key to it. It's proficiency, and hence the pilot proficiency program.
Has the program been around long enough for someone to come back to you and say, listen, I got myself into this and such situation, and I remembered my training, and it really helped me out?
We haven't as of yet, specifically for this program. I can tell you that one of our presenters, and Rich Stoll, the spin doctor, if you go to his website, you'll find testimonials of folks that have gone through his training. And he was really an instrumental part of helping this program get going. They have used exactly what they learned to get out of a situation that they got into. So it does work. And this program itself is so new, just first rolled out here at AirVenture this year, that we haven't had the opportunity to see that yet.
Oh, I'm sure you will. So you're in the Learn to Fly Center, which is exactly where?
The Learn to Fly Center, if you walk down from the main gate and just head towards the flight line, it's going to be on your right-hand side just prior to ConocoPhillips Plaza with a huge sign that says Learn to Fly Discovery Center right across from the EAA membership tent.
Very good.
Easy enough to find.
Yeah, we should find it.
Definitely.
But we need to learn to navigate center so we can figure out where that is.
Yeah, no kidding. We have the GPS coordinates for that.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to Mr. Mark Adams of the SAFE, which is the Society of
Aviation.
Of almost finding everything.
No, it's the Society of Aviation and Flight Educators.
Right.
They're at the Learn to Fly Center. I'm Fast Eddie.
This is Digital Dave.
And we are making a mess of EAA Radio. Lieutenant Commander, are you there?
I am.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
Listen, we wanted to talk to you about rescues and the hurricane hunters. Which one do you actually have more experience with?
Well, we have no, we do not have any of the hurricane hunters in the Coast Guard.
Well, that narrows it down.
Yes, it does.
Narrow it down, yeah.
So you flew rescue missions pretty much exclusively?
Yes, sir.
Helicopter?
Well, I've been flying on all the Coast Guards. I've been in the Coast Guard for almost 30 years, so I've been bouncing around from platform to platform. Not as a pilot, however, but as an air crew member.
I see that it says you spent time in an HC-130 as a navigator.
Yes, sir.
And exactly what is the HC-130? I mean, it's obviously a C-130, but what's the variant?
It's a C-130. It's a Coast Guard variant. The Coast Guard is currently operating two variants of the C-130, the H model, which is one of the 1700 series models. It's configured for Coast Guard operation.
Primary mission at that point is to just locate people in distress?
The primary mission, well, it's a multi-mission platform, and we go out with the intent to locate, and then from the C-130 we can deliver pumps and rafts and survival kits and radios.
You do like an airdrop.
Correct.
How do you do an airdrop onto a ship?
We use what's called a trail line, which is we set up a kit called an MA3 kit, typically, which is a series of containers connected by rope, basically. There's at the end of the rope that's closest to the aircraft at the end of the drop, there's a 300-foot trail line that we hope to drop directly across the bow, not on the bow, but in front of the bow of the vessel, so that the line drifts back into the vessel and they can retrieve it. Sometimes if the vessel's not moving, then we end up dropping that line directly to the vessel, and then they can pull the kit on board.
Okay. Oh, so the rope is tied to whatever you're dropping.
Correct.
And that just provides them a way to reel it in.
Yes, sir.
Now, I was wondering how you would do that.
Yeah, and hopefully whatever you're dropping is not that heavy, they can actually lift it out of the water and get it on board somehow.
It's a series of containers so that it's not one large, heavy container.
And then they put it all together.
Yes.
Well, that sounds quite interesting. I mean, what can you tell us, like, one of your scariest missions? I mean, you know, the one thing that people don't think about when they hear about rescue missions, it's always all about the people in trouble, but the people that go out there are putting themselves in the exact same situation.
Yes, sir. As you know, we will respond in just about any weather conditions. As long as the conditions are adequate for takeoff at the airfield where we're operating from, we'll respond into some, you know, pretty crappy weather.
I would think that most of your missions are probably involving pretty crappy weather.
That is true. Yes, more often than not, it's in pretty inclement weather.
Yeah.
Well, you're up there by near the Bering Sea, correct?
I spent 8 years in Kodiak, Alaska, and flew most missions were out into the Bering and along what's called the Maritime Boundary Line, which is a line between the U.S. and Russian exclusive economic zone.
So, in other words, you're familiar with the rough weather that you get up at the Bering Sea watching Deadliest Catch. I've seen the Coast Guard go in and do rescues. Those guys are really up against it.
Yes, sir. The C-130 is the longer range asset, and we would typically go out in the C-130 and locate the target of interest, if possible, we would drop material to that target, if that's what they needed. If they were taken on water, we might drop a pump to them so they could, either eliminate the problem of taking on water or mitigate that problem until we can get another asset on site. And then if it's necessary to take those folks off of those vessels with a helicopter, we would maintain that surveillance with the C-130 until that helicopter arrives on scene, and likely longer than that, likely all the way through the rescue.
So you just basically orbit the area?
Yes, sir.
Which could make for a really long day, depending upon where you're, how far out to sea you are.
Yes, sir, it could make for a pretty long day. The typical flight out into the Bering is probably 10 hours planned mission time. And then, you know, if you're on a search and rescue case, people are more willing to stay out there as long as possible, and then if necessary, we drop into something like Shimia, the Air Force Station at Shimia, or one of the triple ops, and take on fuel and then go back out.
That does make for a long day. On board the rescue helicopters, you have trained personnel for medical emergencies and stuff like that?
Yes, sir. We carry a rescue swimmer that is EMT trained, and then if it's something that we already know before we send them out that it's going to be beyond the capabilities of an EMT, we'll send out a flight surgeon with that air crew.
Well, that's got to be an interesting ride, and of course all these things happen in the worst of weather.
Absolutely.
How do you guys train for this crummy weather?
We train, you know, the air crews train constantly for adverse conditions. We are constantly going through emergency procedures and going over the aircraft limitations and systems limitations. And then, you know, because we're operating in that weather all the time, what we do is we pre-brief before we get into that weather. And then when we get into that weather, we're constantly talking about what the conditions are doing to the aircraft and how we might, you know, modify our operation to be successful in that weather.
So I guess a rescue on a beautiful blue sky day is just boring.
Well, a rescue case is never boring. When the rescue alarm goes off, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline because everybody wants to go out and save somebody. It's an incredible feeling to go out there and find somebody who's lost or who's in trouble and, you know, provide assistance.
And of course, the opposite side of the coin is it's got to be a big letdown to the crews when they can't find who they're looking for.
Absolutely.
That brings up the subject of the hoax that was recently perpetrated out there, and I think it was California, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, I'm not sure. Yeah.
And I don't know if you're equipped to speak to that, but tell us, I mean, that's just ties up everything needlessly.
Yes, sir. We have a number of hoaxes. I'd hate to give a number, but it's relatively regular occurrence. A hoax that, you know, for instance, a false Mayday call or something like that, a flare that's fired off, without somebody being in danger, is almost the same as when there's an ELT that's going off at an airport because somebody took it off the airplane and laid it on the tarmac, or somebody's cleaning the side of a boat and they pull off the E-perb and lay it down. Everybody responds to those as if they're because that's what we think they are. It's an actual emergency, and it is a tremendous sap on resources, and not just the direct aircraft resources. You have the the aircraft. You have the rescue coordination center that's in the sector command centers. Oftentimes we'll get not just the aircraft heading out onto station, but we also send out surface assets or divert cutters that are already out patrolling on something else. So it oftentimes, you know, the someone is out trying to prosecute their other missions, and some of those might be urgent missions as well, and they get pulled off to respond to what has turned out to be a hoax, and it is a very frustrating, because even if you have an inkling that it might be a hoax, you have to treat every case as if it's an actual emergency.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, sir, I want to thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And you've been listening to Lieutenant Commander Jeffrey Thorwart of the United States Coast Guard. We thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
We have a whole gaggle of people here from the commemorative Air Force.
Sure isn't a bunch?
Bunch, gaggle.
Whatever.
We have two pretty ladies and two manly men here from...
Pilots.
Pilots. They pilot here, they pilot there. Good morning. Can everybody identify themselves, please?
Yes, I'm Debbie King.
Tracy Toth.
I'm David Oliver.
And I'm Steve Brown.
Okay,
he's
now
got
we've
a tag that says President. He must be important.
President.
I'm the only one that doesn't get to fly. That's what happens when you get to be president. You get to stay on the ground.
No, you fly, but it's just a desk, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what kind of ratings do you have to have to fly a desk?
Apparently, you have to have all of them.
Splinters, mostly.
Rated on nice judicious use of sandpaper.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Well, David Oliver, according to information that was passed on to us here, including a color photograph, you get to have the great job of flying Fifi, the CAF's B-29.
Yeah, that's why I get the color photo.
They save that for the important people.
Yeah, right. Believe it or not, man, can you believe that? I get to fly that big silver airplane.
How old are you?
Yeah, he's about 16.
About that.
When I first started flying, I was 29. Same age as Paul Tibbetts when he, of course, did the infamous mission. But I'm 30 years old now, and it just seems so much older.
Well, you first started flying Fifi when you were 29. You didn't first
start flying when you were 29.
That's correct, yeah. First time.
Yeah, he came right out and said, I want to fly that one.
I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express. But
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, they said, hey, you stayed at a Holiday Inn Express. Come on out and fly the B-29.
Hey, that right. looks good. Let's get him in there.
Yeah,
there
he'll look great in the color picture.
Yeah, but you know what? Actually, Randy Sohn, the pilot that flew it out of China Lake in 1971, had, in fact, that he got down off the flight after it landed in Texas, and they said, how many hours do you have in a B-29? He looked at his watch, said, about 6 hours. So, I mean, he literally read the book on the way to the airport.
Wow. Now, I understand the plane is physically hard to fly, like from control force standpoints and things like that.
Yeah, it takes a lot of muscle. There's no doubt about it. I mean, everything on the airplane really is not boosted in any way, so it's all cables and pulleys. I mean, there's a lot of friction in the system. And what they did was, because the control forces were so high and the pilots were complaining about fatigue, they actually re-engineered it so that the control yoke was geared in a way that it would go all the way around 180 degrees. So it's just really big movements.
Wow. Yeah, kind of like driving that old pickup.
Yeah. If you watch, there's a film, I think, that EA did last year, and it's still out there. And it's showing David flying the airplane in. And literally, the deflection is going 180 degrees like this. He's driving the bus very quickly, so it's quite the thing.
Yeah, I don't really go to the gym anymore. I just fly the airplane.
Yeah, so, you don't need to.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to say, how did you get involved with the B-29?
Well, you know what? The Commemorative Air Force is it's really a great organization because it's become something that's really open to a lot of different people, a lot of different demographics, young and old, and it's a great place to just be welcomed. You know, it's a big family is what we say. We have a lot of fun. That's really kind of first and foremost, that we have fun together and we promote the mission to educate and commemorate. So when I got involved, really, it was an open group, and they said, hey, you can start washing the windows. You know, that's the first thing you could do.
I was going to say, did you have to wash the airplane?
Hey, there's a lot of oil you got to wipe. Right? Yeah. To get to fly these airplanes, there's no doubt. But, you know, the ability to get involved and just volunteer is there. There's a lot of opportunities. All you got to do is just really come out and show up and just have an attitude like, hey, what do you need me to do? So you wash windows or you fly the airplane. What do you get to do?
Here's a desk. Fly this for a while.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Dave was talking about what did he do before. When David first came in the organization, I got to know him early because he has another skill set that I knew nothing about, the fact that he could fly, but he came in and volunteered his efforts in filmmaking and editing and putting together. So he helped us put together some really unique pieces that helped us with the Red, White, and Loud tour with Aaron Tippin. Matter of fact, the film piece he does still opens the show that we do with Aaron. And some other videos that he was a videographer a couple years ago on site, did some video vignettes with me in it. All this was going on. I didn't have any clue that David flew, and then I kind of found out he was a pilot. Well, next thing I know, he's flying all kinds of crazy missions. David's got a very varied background in piloting, and next thing you know, he's in the program, and not very long, as you see, he ends up as the pilot in command and the operations officer. So it just goes to show, like David says, you start one place, and a lot of people come in and say, well, and how can I just step into the cockpit? And we don't do it. I mean, we are a big family, but you got to get in with the family. You got to come in, do your time, do a little work, and don't expect you to step in the cockpit and hop out and have somebody else chalk the airplane. We're not an airline, so it's a volunteer organization. Everybody has to pull their load.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people, they say that's like the number one question. How in the world did you get this job? And I always say, well, I just showed up. You know, I mean, seriously, that's what you really got to do is come out and volunteer. That's really all it takes. And we'll welcome you.
A little bit of piloting skill doesn't hurt.
Definitely.
You have to have that for sure.
What did it take for you to get into the left seat on the B-29?
Well, after the checkbook ran out.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the neat thing about the B-29 is that it's supported by its touring and, you know, the shows and venues that it goes to. So for somebody of, you know, kind of maybe a younger age, I can come in, and there's no way, obviously, that I could financially support that airplane. So I did that through my time. You know, that was my contribution to the airplane, was coming out and getting involved. I became the flight operations officer, which was really just a job of logistics, getting the airplane from A to B and figuring out, you know, getting the crew fed and make sure they're happy and have a place to sleep. And then make sure that the airplane does it safely, and learning from a lot of our seasoned members who've been flying this airplane for years. And, you know, there's kind of been a turnover, certainly, because the airplane was down since 2004. And it's really been rescued a couple times through the years. And through the hard work and dedication of all the volunteers with the Commemorative Air Force, they've kept this thing going. So with that came a check out in the right seat. And then it was really probably up to me. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, you know, I've got an opportunity here. How do I maximize it to just go in there and learn everything I can possibly learn about this airplane? I mean, just live, eat, sleep, and breathe B-29. In fact, one day, I remember I was sitting at dinner with my wife, probably kind of, you know, in a daze, staring off in the corner, and she said, "You're thinking about that B-29, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm guilty, you know, because you kind of got to own it a little bit." And I think that's what gave me the ability to transition to the left seat. But I really, really couldn't have done it without the mentorship of a lot of our seasoned members who have a lot of experience with these warbird aircraft. And so that skill and trait is not something that's going to be naturally passed down. We have to be diligent about making sure that these old warbirds are preserved because they're operated in a very particular way.
Well, look, and let's make no doubt about it, David is one of the finest pilots around. There's no doubt about it. He was checked out by Charlie Tillman, who's regarded as one of the best warbird pilots in the world. Charlie recommended David. We've got a lot of pilots that wouldn't be able to step into the role that David did, so he's got the skill. And you ask about the checkbook. You know, the CF is the world's largest airplane co-op. None of our members, nearly none of our members have a lot of money and can support their own warbirds. So there's plenty of guys who can walk in with $2 million and buy a Mustang and buy their way into a cockpit. You can't do that in the CF. And so to be a pilot sponsor on an airplane is a very, actually relatively small financial contribution. The unit itself takes on the care and feeding of these airplanes. So this B-29 is actually a self-sufficient business operation, and we run it like a business because we have to keep that airplane safe, mechanically sound, and with the right pilots. So our whole operation is built on a business model that we can do with volunteers, because there's only about 30 paid staff in the whole organization, of which I'm one of them. But the other 9,500 people that actually keep these airplanes flying are all volunteer.
Do you have problems finding people that want to be the volunteers? I imagine they show up and then find out how much hard the work is, and that changes their mind a little bit.
Well, like any organization that involves people, you know, people get along or they don't get along. It's a family. And sometimes, you know, the kids and mom and dad don't get along. So, and it takes a special person who's got the time and the energy and the resources to volunteer. And we've got people that actually volunteer basically year-round, and people that support this airplane that don't fly. I mean, there's a couple that works as the tour coordinators, the Kim and Phil Parton, who volunteer pretty much year-round for this organization, travel around with Fifi, do a ton of hard work for no pay, just for the reward of being part of it. So, you know, we have a saying, you come for the airplanes, you stay for the people. And so that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and because it's volunteer, I'm sorry to interject, but because it's a volunteer organization, we all want to be here. We all have this common denominator, this common thread of this passion for these airplanes and the generation it represents. So it's very easy for us to show up and very easy for us to quote-unquote work when we don't mind grabbing the rag and wiping the oil because it's something we all enjoy. So none of us have to be there. We all want to be there, and we do it as much as possible.
Now, we've talked about pilots and what it takes to become a pilot. How about a mechanic? Not everybody can turn a wrench, and certainly on something as complicated as that aircraft. Do you have trouble finding mechanics and people that are qualified to do the maintenance work?
Yeah, there's no doubt that these airplanes are not maintained like a modern airline aircraft. Parts and pieces are difficult to come by. We say that we could really fabricate any part with modern machinery, but that it's not necessarily going to be very cheap, right? So, or inexpensive. So these guys are really, you know, for instance, we had a couple boost pumps, you know, that we've had some issues with this year, and they go back to the overhaul shop. Well, this boost pump might have been overhauled 20 or 30 times in its lifespan, you know, and so there's a degradation there, even in the overhaul. So getting the mechanics mindset is certainly very important, and we've got in our squadron, you know, two full-time guys who just maintain the B-29, the B-24, and now a Beech-18 that are just full-time, and those guys are absolutely fantastic. But they really are a breed in of themselves because they've really honed in their skill on warbirds.
Yeah, and different warbirds require different levels of skill. And we've got plenty of AMPs that are and AIs that are members, and they supervise you know, non-mechanically skilled laborers that get in there and work on the airplanes.
I've shown up and just asked, what can I do? And if the bomb bay door is, you know, requiring some kind of a wrench turn, they'll come over and show you exactly what they want, do it, they come back, check it, and they'll put you on another project. It works out really well.
Yeah, they're really very open. I mean, people come in, they say, well, how can I help? We just put them right to work. There's, you know, there's definitely jobs that can be done under supervision.
Do you guys have any units above the Mason-Dixon line? We're from Pennsylvania, so.
Yeah, we do. We've got units in Washington, D.C. area, in Virginia. So we've got one in Warrenton. We've got one just outside of Norfolk. We've also got a new unit in Rhode Island with a T-6. And then, of course, in the Midwest, we have other units. So there's quite a few. We've got one in Minneapolis, just over the road from here. And so there's actually 70 units spread among 28 states.
Wow.
Plenty of opportunities.
Plenty of opportunities, definitely.
Well, we'd like to thank you all for coming in, because we probably drug you out of bed.
Well, if you got a minute, what I want to tell you about, and what you're seeing represented here is the new face of the CAF. You know, we came from the World War II generation, where it was predominantly men, predominantly older men that had flown in the war. And now this is, you're seeing the new face of the CAF. You've got two ladies here, both co-pilots in the B-24, four-engine bombers. David, as you heard, with the B-29, and we've got the diversity of the Red Tail project that we've got going on, with the son of a Tuskegee Airman as the leader. And we've got women and men, young women and men, leading different units in the organization. So it's not just if you're an old guy with a lot of time and money. That's not who we are. We're the changing face of the CF, and this is really representative of it.
Very good. Well, I want to again thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. I'm Fast Eddie.
This is Digital Dave.
And you're listening to EAA Radio.
I am Lynn May with the DAV flight team.
Okay, that Dave's flight team?
Now, you know what? If it was Dave, wouldn't it have an E on it?
No.
No, not the way I spell.
Okay. No, you know, it's funny, though. We get a lot of people come up to us and say, what is DAV?
Yeah.
You know, and we're the Disabled American Veterans. And the reason we do the outreach program that we're here to do in Oshkosh is to tell people who we are and what we do and what we're about. And we do a lot of exciting things to get them to come see us. And, you know, just public awareness. That's what it's all about.
And then I guess you'd make it possible for some disabled veterans to fly?
It's rare that we go to a show when a veteran or whoever says, hey, how can I get a ride on that airplane?
Yeah, okay.
You know, we bring in the B-25.
Come on, veterans.
Yeah, there you go. But the B-25 is one of those beautiful airplanes that really does draw some attention. And, you know, that airplane's earned it. It launched off the Hornet during World War II to bomb Tokyo. As you saw yesterday, that first and last flights, the first flight on there, and those guys were volunteers. Such rich history. And that mission was so important back in 1942. Wow. But I'll tell you what. The B-25 is here on another mission, and that's one of public service and service to veterans. And that's why we're here.
And by B-25, we're talking, of course, about Panchito.
Yes, we are.
And you can't miss this thing. It's polished so nicely. You can shave in this thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you guys are not doing anything later, you want to come by, we'll give you a rag and some polish. And
oh,
we shine that all the time. Yeah, yeah,
I thought you were going to let us shave in it or something.
I was hoping they let us sit in the cockpit and make engine noises, but so much for that.
Okay.
Well, we would do that for you.
Uh-oh. And why as for long me as and not for him?
Because they need something to put up on YouTube.
Well, I think we've already made that. Thank you very much.
Well, the B-25, like I said, the history is so rich, and the mission is so important. I know you talked with Don Samuels earlier in the week,
yes, ma'am.
Our national commander, and he told you so much about the down nitty-gritty benefits and the reason that we do what we do for veterans, and those things are so important. But, you know, right along with that, we like to have a good time. We bring in the B-25 to keep that history alive. We talk to the young folks, not only the veterans that are coming back, but some of the young people that come by. They don't know what the DAV is all about. They don't. Some of them don't understand really what those veterans did for them. You know, all gave some. Some gave all.
Right,
exactly. For our freedom. So we can't say enough about them and be grateful enough. But we have a good time. We have stickers we give out. We have information about the B-25 and the DAV. We got all kinds of brochures. We bring in the local DAV chapter members to come and work with us there at our display. Because if you have a specific question, you know, where do you guys meet? What time's your meetings? Or what do you do about this or that? Or how could I get a ride to the VA hospital if I need it? Those are the people that really can answer those questions. We bring it in, we create that awareness, and we make it available to anybody out there. And, you know, they do the rest. So they're all my heroes. I get to travel the country with this program, reaching out to the veterans and the patriotic public, and I get to meet America's greatest heroes, and that's all those veterans out there. No matter what their job was, if they served our country, they're my heroes.
And emphasized nicely, I'd say, with that jet pass.
Absolutely.
That's right. Sound of freedom, right?
Hey, there you go.
There it is.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate everything you've done for the disabled American vets, and maybe someday they won't need your services because we won't make any more. But,
well, you know, that's kind of a lovely thought.
Yeah, I know, but this
Wouldn't
is the real world.
Wouldn't I be out of a world. Job, though?
No, hey, no. Would you mind being out of that job, though?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, like I said, we can't do enough for them, and we really want to emphasize that it's veterans helping veterans, and we're not just here for veterans, but here to tell everybody out there what you can do to help as well. I mean, donate to your local DAV. Donate your time. You can volunteer to drive. You can volunteer for each individual chapters. They have all kinds of projects that they do for their community that is specific to their area. So there's all kinds of things. And man, what better job would there be than to helping a veteran?
Absolutely. You have a website, I'm assuming?
You would be correct.
And what would that be?
That?
Let's just pull it right out of you.
You're tough. Go to dav.org, and you can get any information. You get information about a chapter in your local area. You can get information about some of the services that are available, some of the activities and things that are going on. You know, you could even find a little area that says air shows and see where we're going to be next with the DAV flight team. Also, if you're on Facebook, you can go to DAV Flight Team and like us on Facebook. When you do that, you're entered in a chance to win a beautiful wooden model of the B-25 Panchito. We give away one per year to all the new likes on Facebook. So, you know.
I'll be right back.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, go do that. Also, if you're out here at EAA Air Venture, stop down at Warbird Alley and see us. We're also going to give away one of those models at the end of the week here.
So very nice.
That'd be a nice little surprise to get in the mail in a couple weeks, a nice brand new wooden model of Panchito, right?
Yep.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
You guys are going to come down and enter?
I don't know if we're allowed to. You know, Radio People's Association.
Yeah, blah, 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 blah.
Whatever. Yeah, we'll be there.
Yeah. Good answer. Good answer.
Go. So. As hand as a rag, we'll polish the plane, sit in the cockpit, make engine noises, and try to win the plane.
Wow.
You've got a plan.
I was going to say.
We really appreciate you guys because we're out here to spread the message about the DAV, and we couldn't do it without people like you helping us get on the air here and tell the people what we're all about and what we're doing.
Should, I don't know. After the way we started this show, you probably wished you'd gotten on someone else's program.
Should we tell her that we volunteered in other places and they turned us down?
Yeah, exactly. This was
we
last
wound
resort.
Up here, last ditch effort.
Hey, you guys haven't seen me crack the whip, see?
Oh,
I'll
boy.
I'll put you to work.
Oh, boy.
Mike and I run the outreach program, and we love what we do. We're passionate about it. We want to keep that history alive, and we really, really in our hearts agree with the mission of the DAV, which is building better lives for our nation's disabled veterans and their families. So, you know, it's in our hearts, we love it, and we want everybody to come join in.
Not only that, but it's also a very worthy cause, helping out all our disabled veterans. And God knows they need the help because the government, well, you know, all you got to do is mention government and everybody just groans.
Well, one of the big things we do is we help them with all that paperwork. We represent them the way an attorney would represent you in court. We help the veteran and represent them when they go to the VA to apply for their...
Feels like the same thing, though, doesn't it?
Well, sometimes to some of them it probably does.
Yeah.
But we do everything we can to make that process a little easier.
I guess even just explaining to them how this process works is a tremendous help.
Well, the paperwork in itself is overwhelming. And, you know, did you ever get government paperwork you had to do and you thought, yeah, is it worth it? We have a volunteer with us that said, you know, Lynn, the reason I do this so much for the DAV is because when I got out of the service, I waited 13 years before I applied for my benefits. And he said, that was 13 years I could have got those benefits that I earned, and I just didn't get around to doing it. And that's why what we're doing here is so important. We want to reach out, especially the young people that are coming back now. They don't know what benefits they're entitled to. And if they do, they don't really know how to go about the process to get those benefits. And doggone it, they've earned them. It's not like we're giving them a handout. They've earned those benefits by paying the price for us. And we want them to know what's available and help them get what they've earned.
Absolutely.
That sounds like a worthy cause.
Very worthy cause. Don't forget, check out the website, dav.org. Or if you're on the property, come on down and see Panchito. You can't miss it. And, of course, for you
like them on Facebook.
For you Facebookers, you can like them on Facebook. It's DAV Flight Time.
Flight Team.
Flight Team.
Oh, jeez. I'm
losing it. Well, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Also, we're, I think, at 10 o'clock. We're doing Warbirds in Review, and Panchito is featured with maybe the Raiders.
Okay.
But, you know, yeah, come on down to Warbird Alley, take a look around, see what the DAV's all about. We'll answer any questions you have.
Very good.
And I'll let you polish the plane, too.
Oh.
Always,
oh, yeah.
Always.
There's always something leaking out of one of those radial engines that needs to be cleaned
up.
Thank
goodness.
You've been listening to Lynn May from the Disabled American Veterans. I'm Fast Eddie.
I'm Digital Dave, and this is EAA Radio.
What's left of it.
Yes.